First Annual Research Symposium on the Late Effects of Poliomyelitis, May 25th to 27th, 1984, held at the Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation, Warm Springs, Georgia. Tape K201-8, Epidemiological Issues and Follow-Up Studies of the Impact of Poliomyelitis, presenter Joseph Kaufert. Post-Polio Pain, Treatment by Sublingual Immunotherapy, presenter Ann A. Bailey.
Are there any other, let's start with the this afternoon's program. The first presenter is Joseph Kaufert, PhD, who is going to talk on the epidemiological issues in follow-up studies of the impact of poliomyelitis. Dr. Kaufert is adjunct professor of anthropology and associate professor of social and preventive medicine at the University of Manitoba. Dr. Kaufert.
Thing I should probably indicate that I'm not a neurophysiologist and feel a bit of a layman in terms of some of the discourse here. It's a bit like the story that's told of Will Rogers during the First World War. He was touring the Allied naval facilities and talking to one of the commanders of the North Atlantic Fleet who described the incredible loss to submarine warfare. And they asked him as a layperson whether he had any ideas about solving the submarine menace. And he said, if you could raise the temperature of the North Atlantic by 3 or 4 degrees centigrade, you'd increase the volume within the U-boats and could deal with them on the surface. And they said, that's a nice concept, Mr. Rogers, but what about the practicality? What about the implementation? He said, that's your problem. I only deal in concepts. I think sometimes epidemiology is a bit like that in dealing with populations, but I think the outstanding study that was described this morning in Rochester and the broader plan study for Olmsted County are part of the interface of narrower specific clinical research, which is clearly being developed in forums like this, with wider population-based studies and larger national studies like Dr. Halstead and your colleagues. This paper is really an attempt to address some of the methodological issues in population-based research in post-polio aging among people who developed respiratory and non-respiratory variants of polio in the major epidemics of the 1950s in Winnipeg, Manitoba, in central Canada. Could I have the first slide, please, Dr. Rowe? This histogram is essentially the years of the 1950s showing the case incidence, and you can see comparing it with the data that we saw in the Minnesota data that our peak epidemic, the largest year, was 1953. We had a somewhat large epidemic in 1952. The title of this is somewhat erroneous. This includes both respiratory and non-respiratory cases. There were 3,645 cases of polio registered in the province between 1950 and 1959, with the highest incidence in 1953 when we had 2,371 cases. This is about the same incidence rate between 3 and 400 as you see in the Olmsted County data. Very dense in the impact of it in terms of the medical care system is that we're a province of only about 1 million people. So you can think of approximately 4,000 cases spread out within this population with only one centralized treatment and rehabilitation center. Most of the acute cases and all cases with any respiratory involvement were triaged to one central treatment facility, the Winnipeg Municipal Hospitals. This complex was officially designated as the treatment center, and it provided the basis for a population-based registry. We were able to obtain baseline clinical data and data from a prospectively developed medical record audit and polio case register that was maintained from 1950 by far-sighted clinicians who I was fortunate enough to have around and guiding me in the early side of this study. So we had both historical prospective data in terms of medical record audit and even some data on initial impairment profiles on all individuals within the study. In dealing specifically with the population of people who were admitted to the Winnipeg Municipal Hospitals, we initially had the advantage of being able to look at the provincial registry and to determine what kind of selectivity resulted in admission to the centralized treatment facility. And so we began the epidemiological process by making some basic kinds of comparisons here with this much larger number of all reported cases. The first study that we began to deal with, and much of the data that I'll be presenting today, dealt with the 264 cases that received mechanical respiratory support. This is a massive number of cases. At one time, we had 111 active cases with respiratory support in iron lung within the single treatment facility. In this paper, we want to discuss some of the methodological and conceptual issues that are involved in researching the long-term consequences of any chronic disability, but in particular poliomyelitis at the population level. The first area that I'd like to consider is the issues of survey design and the difficulties of controlling for selection bias that we already discussed a bit this morning in comparing the two other follow-up surveys that you've heard about here today. The first section will therefore deal with the ways and the kinds of ways of comparing data between self-selected samples, assessing the kinds of selectivity that we've seen in the other studies. The second section really looks at the problems of measuring functional status retrospectively, and I think it has implications for one of our tasks. If we're going to do conjoint and shared polio research, the possibility of using a forum like this to come up with some common measures. If we're going to use ADL, let's be clear of what we're going to use. If we're going to look at respiratory dependence, let's be clear about our criteria, even mobility criteria between Minnesota and Manitoba with our climatic conditions and southern studies may have to be looked at and standardized. The third section of the paper will examine the problems of validating retrospective self-reported analysis of functional status. We all take a history and we assume that data gathered through the respondent's recall of 30 years ago falls in the same cognitive framework as recent medical experience that we use. One of the unique things with studies like the Rochester data and the Manitoba data is that we have functional profiles or mobility ratings or respiratory data that goes back over 35 years. We can really examine the kind of recall artifacts and the problems that people have reconstructing data retrospectively. The final area that I'll just mention and present some data, which the slides just came off the day before I left, is the problem of using multivariate kinds of approaches to control for aging-related effects where we have longitudinal data on functional status. How is it that we deal with age gradients of people whose respiratory status has changed, whose ADL performance has changed, and whose mobility status has changed consistently, or it's gone through highs and lows over a 30-year period? Statistically, it's a problem that all three of us are going to have to cope with, and I'll just present some very preliminary data. Let me talk a little bit about the idea of the historical prospective study and problems of selection bias. At this conference, our current concern over the relationship between the aging process and the long-term impact of polio has really included three kinds of studies. Those based on self-selected populations who have come forward, many of them experiencing post-polio aging effects. Many of the clinical studies from highly selected clinical populations in contact with rehabilitation medicine or who have reestablished contact with some of the kind of input that neurophysiologists presented. And thirdly, population-based studies. Inevitably, self-selected populations tend to overrepresent groups with the highest levels of disability. The greatest propensity possibly to experience post-polio aging effects and the highest current levels of contact with rehabilitation or with the kind of self-help kinds of things that the conferences that Jenny Lowry has run through the Rehab Gazette. They're really different kinds of populations than the overall national or international population of post polio. There are clearly advantages to focusing on these individuals with the highest level of need and highest recent effects. However, this method of studying a study, of selecting a study population, means that we know very little of those, one, who did not survive, and two, we underrepresent those who recovered so completely that they rejoined the normal population, and unless they've happened to see some of the post-polio aging results, may well not be represented in self-selected studies. We really need to document the experience of people who didn't survive until the 1980s, as was presented in Murray's survivorship analysis and one that I'll present. We also need to document the experience of the less residually disabled people who mainstreamed in the community. In order to do this, the ideal study would include, first, a longitudinal design. Second, it would select its sample from a complete list of everybody that had polio within a defined geographical area. And as long as you're wishing, your third criteria might be that you would begin your study, at least retrospectively, at the point of disease onset. In research on polio and aging, a true prospective design is obviously very difficult to achieve, except in the third world. But epidemiology offers the possibility of doing what's called historical prospective designs. For example, a population of patients with lung cancer, looking at the impact of asbestos exposure, might look at common exposure at the point of onset from occupational histories. The research objective is to see how a group that shares a common risk factor fares over a long period of time. Transferring this methodology to research on polio means that we've got to go back to lists of people as they developed the disease in order to determine what happened to everyone, including the non-survivors and the individuals who have mainstreamed. The sampling approach that we used in the Manitoba design is probably impossible to really see, but we fortunately had the population registry that had demographic data. It had data on the first 3 years of medical care received. It had a basic profile, not in functional status terms, because this was 1952 through 59, but we had a general body area using the 1-3 impairment scale. It was possible to place all of this data from the entire sample of respiratory and virtually all of the non-respiratory cases into a machine-readable computerized format, and then to really do two surveys. One, an interviewer-administered survey that was a very detailed follow-up of our respiratory cases, and secondly, a Mulder method mail telephone follow-up survey of about 1,150, of whom we found 725 of the non-respiratory cases. The final phase of the research that's going on now, that's one that I kept thinking of Hugh's statement last night, is using the data that we got on the initial medical record audit and the data on the follow-up through surveys to select a relatively small sample, about 40 individuals representing particular disability groups, representing particular care experience such as home care, and doing 3-4 hour recorded life histories about their experience with rehabilitation medicine to try to map what we're finding in an epidemiological level on the kind of medical care interests that the conferences that Ginny Lowry convenes very often deal with, to try to come up with a more individual biographical experience of respiratory survivors and other cases. In terms of our own register, we basically had, a total number of cases who had confirmed via lumbar puncture and other neurological evaluation, 1,540 patients who had been admitted to the hospitals with polio with a confirmed diagnosis. In the first study, we selected only those who required mechanical respiratory support. This sample gave us 264 individuals, which was reduced further to 186 individuals who survived 100 days after polio onset. So this was essentially our target grouping. In only 8 cases was it impossible to determine whether the individual is still alive or to find out some idea of their location to begin case finding. Within this group of 186 people, 56 were known to have died prior to March 31st, 1980. 24 died in hospitals within the first year, and their medical records provided all of the real data. We didn't do a follow-up either with informants or with the individuals themselves. Out of the 130 individuals who were known or thought to be alive at the time of the interview, we were able to successfully complete direct interviews with 113 and with informant interviews among an additional 25 recently deceased individuals. I'm not presenting any of the informant data because I think it presents very real problems and it isn't included in the analysis. In the first stage, our response rate was 74%, but it was interesting in terms of the questions of selective bias. When we looked at our respondents versus non-respondents using the clinical audit data, the thing that Laurel mentioned this morning was very clear, that of our heavily respiratory disabled, those continuously dependent on respiratory equipment, we found 97% of them. Among those with lower level respiratory disability, including people using no respiratory support in the community, we were only able to find 76% of them. And the epidemiological issue is really this selectivity in terms of who we found. Despite the difficulties involved in tracing people after this kind of an interview, as you saw in Murray's study this morning, survivorship analysis is not only possible, but a very important part of this. We can document survivorship. We need to use more sophisticated methodology to look at the reasons for people who have been deceased recently, looking at early deaths and this kind of thing. In the Manitoba respiratory study, because we had 2 of the attending physicians involved in it, before I go on, I should just show you the demographics of the respiratory subsample. Basically, we had 62% male, 38% female. We had an age distribution, when you plot it, that it's amazingly similar to the Olmsted County Rochester ones, with the very young and the young adult lumping of cases. This typology of the respiratory cases, as many of you pointed out, presents real problems because there were mixed effects. We also have data on the amount of post-acute time spent initially in iron lungs before they went on to other forms of respiratory support or were weaned from iron lungs. As I was saying, it's possible to do survivorship analysis on it. We essentially audited the records and pathology and the death records of the 54, eventually 56 individuals who died before 1980. The panel of three physicians that actually did this part of the study attempted to dichotomize them. In fact, there was a much more complex scoring system that they used, where they used an intermediate polio-related effect, sort of secondary complications of respiration or cardiovascular effects. But this diagram, which is really too faint to see, shows the cases, which are all these very faint ones, where the pathology looked as though there was polio relationship. The black cases are cases where there was no apparent polio or latent polio secondary effect. Again, in terms of the considerations that have been brought out here, the pathology of this is incredibly complex, and this is clearly a very rough estimate. But this is related on this curve here, the individual's years of survival, which these three gradients, and the actual age at onset of the individual. You can see some of the individuals who were quite old at onset, the deaths were rated as polio unrelated, but it's a very complex pathological problem. The only point I'm making for the standpoint of this talk is that it's necessary to look at the mortality effects in going on to interview survivors. We've got to understand who we're left with in terms of residual populations. Next, I'd like to deal with a kind of measurement problem, some of the things that we might address in the working group in terms of deciding the kinds of measurement criteria that we might use in measuring functional status. The case register that we had not only provided medical and social demographic and some data on employment and early marital status, but it also provided data which could be used in a retrospective clinical audit and placed into contemporary terms in terms of measures of mobility, COTS type ADL measures, and measures of functional status, which I'll talk about in just a moment. Without medical or record audit-based data on people's status during the acute and early rehabilitation phases, most studies of long-term disability have to really rely on what people recall about their individual condition. The design of the Manitoba study really provided us with a double opportunity. First of all, we could use the medical records and our fellow clinicians' audit in order to look at recall artifacts. Secondly, they had allowed us to form some basic ideas about the validity of data, the role of informants in helping post-polios to recall what happened to them, the relative impact of recent encounters with medical care on it. The two clinicians, Dr. John Hildes and Dr. Jack Alcock, had both been members of the medical team involved in the 52, 53, and in Dr. Alcock's case up through 1959. They were therefore familiar with all of the acute records, and they were essentially able to enter the medical record audit data into a format that paralleled the survey format that our side of the study was using. In terms of respiratory status measures, we basically used the system that Jeffrey Spencer developed in the St. Thomas's Respironaut studies of respiratory dependence. We actually had the number of hours a day of respiratory dependence serially, and we had on a limited subsample of 35 individuals some serial spirometry, so it was possible to look longitudinally at some of the changes in peak flow and other tidal volume kinds of measures. But in order to simplify things and keep our study mappable in terms of the British work, and mainly to use some of the British data that I was involved in gathering on the costs of home care versus institutional care, we used the five categories based on a 24-hour system. Complete independence, occasional dependence, particularly for intermittent respiratory problems, 12-hour or more, or less than 12-hour dependence on continuous respiratory support, 12 to 18 or 18 hours. This is a rank order type of category, and in multivariate data, you could actually use the number of hours. In some respiratory studies, it may be very useful to actually try to deal with the number of hours. We measured it initially at two points in time because we had the clinician's estimate for 1 year after onset during the period of initial stabilization. Our initial study was done in 1980. However, we also attempted to use the kind of thing that Dr. Halstead has done, trying to get people also to give us the specific timing of optimal and lowest levels of respiratory performance. And we tried to use these same data points in the mobility and ADL scales that we used in the rest of the study. In terms of these kinds of measures and the questions that Dr. Halstead is raising, it's interesting that about 77% had their lowest volume of lowest level of self-reported respiratory function within the first 3 years, which is understandable. But most of them had reached close to their optimal level within 5 to 6 years after polio onset. The interesting group were the 17%, where the lowest levels of respiratory function were achieved or experienced 25 to 30 years after the acute stage. As I said again, the data that we have in terms of serial respiratory data is relatively limited, but it shows a similar pattern. In terms of measures of mobility, we used a similar kind of categorization, and some of the analysis that I won't present parallels Laurel's analysis of hospitalized versus non-hospitalized patients, but with the respiratory, there was a critical group that we were interested in terms of the polio respiratory home care, which in 55, 56 was one of the first programs in North America that provided home respiratory equipment. And in both the respiratory and other functional status data, we've tried to do the kind of comparison that Dr. Halstead presented for his hospitalized versus non-hospitalized, looking at discharge categories. Very clearly, they're different populations. In terms of the mobility measures that we used, we tended to use a fairly consistent mobility rating scale. We tended to use winter-summer measurements. To this, we added some other complex ones, including in riding in cars, using adapted transport, and using public transportation, because in addition to standard ambulation kinds of parameters, community integration seemed to relate as much to common kinds of things like walking, chair transfer, bed transfer, or toilet transfer, than to complex kinds of things like ability to ride in a wheelchair van, ability to drive oneself. To the standard COTS ADL inventory, we added a few more specific polio kinds of inventories. Basically, the three groups that we looked at, including the discharge categories, in terms of gross measures of performance, non-performance, were of course markedly different. Those continuous inpatients, people that were really in the hospital for 25 years, had very low levels of performance unassisted for all of these. The home care program was slightly higher, 5 minutes left, okay. And the other one was just slightly, the free discharge people were really at a much higher level. So those are the measures we used. Let me just briefly mention the other two. Dr. Alva's given me 5 minutes, which is fine. What I'll do, basically, is show you the problems of looking at change in both respiratory status and ADL over time. You can do an analysis at two points in time or more points in time if you've got the data of looking at the whole population group and seeing levels of performance 1 year post-acute and now or at intermediate points. But that only gives you an idea of how the whole population changed. Basically, what you've got to do is use multivariate techniques that control for age within the individuals and within age subsets of a population. So even though it looks like you've got marked kinds of improvement in ADL performance and equivalent kinds of changes in similar measurements of respiratory function, you basically have to look using continuous kinds of variables, using regression, comparing high and low disability groups within age strata in order to understand those kind of long-term aging effects that you're dealing with at a physiological level. What I'll just do is present two quick tables which look at the problem, and this one just came off the computer and you don't have to necessarily read it, but we were concerned with the validity of recall data on the acute and rehabilitation phase. We therefore took the fact that we had two measures from the clinicians and the chart audit, one of respiratory status on the same scale, one of mobility using the same scale. ADL measurements didn't exist in 52, 53 as such. We tried a rough retrospective chart audit on those. But what we did is we looked at the correlations of survey-based self-reported measures with clinical measures. And what we actually found was that people's recall of the 1 year post-acute for respiratory status was really rather high. We had a Pearson's core and also a non-parametric core of about 0.83 in this. And in fact, all of the intercorrelations were significant at the 0.01 level. The interesting thing was that there was so little change in respiratory status that the post 1 year levels were relatively highly correlated with the 1980 levels. The levels for mobility in terms of the correlation between the medical record audit and the chart audit were somewhat lower. The ADL measures tended to be somewhat higher. And what it really, I think, showed in terms of doing retrospective research is that we can come up with relatively good ballpark estimates. But if we're going to talk about either timing in terms of something occurring in a specific year up to the last 5 or 6 years, we may be dealing with recall biases. And we actually control for the age of the person and their level of recall and their use of informants. About 50% of the non-respiratory and about 47% of the respiratories had to use other people to reconstruct their acute experience and their experience for the first 15 years after polio. Let me just mention the last two kinds of findings because they're the only ones that really relate to polio and aging. What we essentially did was a series of regression studies looking at age, looking at sex variation within our respiratory sample, and looking at both age at onset and age as a continuous variable. And what we basically found, sorry, this is just another intercorrelation showing that all three of the functional status, respiratory status, mobility, and ADL are all very highly intercorrelated, that people with respiratory involvement had heavy effects in these other levels. The non-respiratory cases have high mobility ADL intercorrelation, as you'd expect. The last two tables basically showed relatively strong age effects in terms of respiratory status, mobility, less so for, and these are at the 2 points in time, 1 year post-acute and 1980. We haven't included any of the intermediate effects. Relatively high impact of age, sex differentiation between men and women's changes only in mobility variables, and that may be as much an artifact of the sort of gender biases that we have in the ways we measure mobility. Let me just conclude with sort of the last three lines, which are probably don't address Will Rogers' bias that we only deal in concepts. But in summary, our experience in trying to develop follow-up studies of populations of respiratory and non-respiratory poliomyelitis patients has demonstrated the feasibility of applying epidemiological approaches. We found that historical prospective designs allow us to look for the representativeness of populations. In this group, to facilitate comparative research, we advocate the development of consistent indices rather than reinventing the wheel in Rochester, Minneapolis, Houston, and Winnipeg. If we could even come up with some common agreement to use COTS or a modification of it for ADL and some common mobility things, we're going to be better off. In our evaluation of the validity of retrospective self-reported measures of functional status through comparison of post-acute and individual recall-based measures, we found a high degree of correlation in gross measures, but we feel that some caution needs to be exercised in terms of the specificity of the measures that are beyond 5 years. Finally, our preliminary attempts to evaluate post-polio aging effects indicate that age at onset was significantly correlated with changes in all three functional status variables. I apologize, that was a long 5 minutes.
Are there some questions or comments for Dr. Crawford?
I should have had a neurobiologist on the team and I would have... I beg your pardon? What? Yeah, Richard.
I'll restrain myself. Bruno from New York. Dr. Codd this morning described the incidence of problems in the Rochester population. And I've encountered a lot of resistance from folk who are not as aware as we are of post-polio problems. and the resistance goes along the lines of, well, there aren't many post-polios anyway, and I'm afraid that people who listen to the tape will say, well, there ain't many of them to begin with, and only 22% of them are having some kinds of problems. Could you say something in general about extrapolating from populations to the, or samples to the population?
I think there are two sides to it. One, we need some incidence data to take the wider national work. I think it gives consumer organizations clout, even if we're only talking about 20%. It's very important for the generalizability of the microclinical studies and the animal model studies. I think the dilemma with epidemiological studies of populations that aren't self-selected raises an ethical issue of raising the issue of post-polio aging. And so the care that clearly went into Laurel and Mary's questionnaire and that we tried to exercise, you tread a line between asking a very ambiguous question and labeling a phenomena of leading somebody so deeply into a set of questions dealing with post-polio aging that you have a real labeling problem within your questionnaire. And I think we need to really evaluate that. On the other hand, to do better epidemiological work on post-polio aging, we need to ask more specific questions. And it's a real dilemma, but you know, between which approach you take. One of the ones that I've tried to do was do in-depth kinds of things with stratified subsamples, where in sitting there for 3 or 4 hours, I can probe, as a clinician would, many of the subsets of disability experience, and then kind of map it onto the epidemiological data.
I'm Richard Owen from Minneapolis. One of the things that I feel is important in this type of study, Joe, is identifying a number of people so that we'll have a group to work on prospectively from now on. I've found the inaccuracies of patient history and old charts even going over those as such a major block to understanding the status of the individual as a person 30 or 40 years ago, that I'm looking forward to a prospective study of individuals we get our hands on and our data and get into our data banks now so that we can look over the next 10, 15, or 20 years at the, or however long they last.
Yeah, to use it, the survey as an enrollment, I think the ethical issue, one that we did all right with at the respiratory level because we had interest in current respirology, but we didn't have the rheumatology and wider rehab, and so I had real issues with the 530 people that I contacted, that the referral resource was very often directing them to Warm Springs or directing them to Edmonton because we didn't have a parallel linkage and they weren't being enrolled. And I think the optimal study offers the person some kind of involvement in a cohort that may eventually provide services. I'm really concerned with that as an epidemiologist. Mary.
I would just go along with what Dr. Owen has said. I think that the group that we have who have indicated that they are stable between onset of polio and maximal recovery in the present time provides such a group. And I would foresee that we could perhaps start with baseline measurements, EMG, ergonometric measurements, and follow this group through for 15, 20 years as a prospective study.
That's proposed because we have so many respiratory, and the data is directly being used. I was lucky enough to come up with a reprint from Dr. Fisher and some of the costing work that was done at Dr. Alba's at Goldwater. And that was directly used in the respiratory polio network to extend the what had been a very good early respiratory home care program, but was facing larger numbers of people who were requiring 24-hour coverage, and where the costing data from other centers was absolutely vital in keeping our program going.
Just one final comment, sort of tag on to Dick, what you were saying. One of the things that strikes me about this whole meeting is that we're having a great deal of difficulty with the whole business of terminology. And I think all of us recognize that taxonomy is perhaps one of the most important foundation stones of medicine and of advances in medicine. And until we're clear about the names and what those names stand for, it just becomes extraordinarily difficult to get on with proper treatments. So on the one hand, we can criticize that the records of 30 years ago were not very good. On the other hand, I'm not sure the records of today are going to be that much better in the sense that we don't really have an agreed upon taxonomy, and I think that's going to be one of the challenges in the next year or two.
I think also in terms of your fifth objective of the research diffusion, the idea of using categories that have meaning within the networks, when Ginny reports a meeting like this and she reports respiratory or ADL, is there a social meaning and impact for the consumer network? And that's, these final interviews have very often a matched spouse or significant other. One of the side issues that interests me as somebody that was originally a social scientist is the family aging. We've looked at the effect of aging of the main helper and the interaction between ADL of the significant helper and the post-polio person. I think there's a conference that would be as broadly based as this, looking at the social and family adaptation, but this is not the forum.
Thanks. Joe, thanks very much. Our next speaker is Dr. Ann Bailey, formerly of the Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation, and now in private practice here in Warm Springs, Georgia. Dr. Bailey is going to discuss post-polio pain and its treatment by sublingual immunotherapy. Dr. Bailey.
I guess first I have to say that I should get the gold star for bravery to have the nerve to come up here and talk to all of you people who are so well-founded in research and have such good presentations and all that. I'm strictly a clinician, and what I have to say is just what I've observed in trying to treat my patients. And I guess I'll add to the problem of terminology by saying that I want to talk about polio pain. And I don't mean by that any of the types of pain that have been mentioned so many times during the past couple of days now. I don't mean any of the orthopedic pains or joint pains or fibrositis type pains or a muscle pain as such, but for lack of a better term, what I call polio pain, and maybe Dr. Johnson can help me come up with a better name for that. This is a strange kind of pain that the patients have a great deal of difficulty in describing themselves, and certainly not every post-polio patient has it, and maybe that's a bad term too. I would estimate maybe about 20% of the 20% who are having troubles. They'll complain of a deep pain. They'll say it feels like a bone pain or a nerve pain, or that I feel like I have flu, or those who can remember say, I feel like I have polio all over again. So it is different from the other, can I have the first slide? Rather diffuse, it's hard for them to localize, though it may be worse in a limb that is being overworked. It's constant, and it's not responsive to the usual analgesics. It does get worse with exertion or if a patient gets sick. It's not relieved by rest, and it's often accompanied by headache and insomnia, or a kind of restlessness that the patients have trouble describing.
This is the end of side one. Please turn your tape over now to continue listening on side two.